I pronounce the opening of the Mike Nichols Sale.
I bought a mare in Poland for $9,000. I sold her for $450,000.
It's just money, 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 everywhere you looked.
I sold her daughter for $175,000.
And frankly, having met that mare, you know, if I'd had a couple of million, I might have flunked it down, too.
And 6 months later, the man to whom I sold the filly sold her at auction for $680,000.
In the United States, the Arabian horse has always had a reputation for being exotic, exquisitely beautiful, and rare. Even as Arabian horses grew in popularity and numbers during the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, their exotic reputation stuck with them. When Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980, one of his first acts was to create tax incentives for a wide range of businesses in order to stimulate the economy. Without particularly meaning to, he made the horse breeding business into a giant tax shelter. With extremely friendly tax laws and their exotic reputation, the Arabian horse became the sweetheart of millionaires. Almost overnight, breeding Arabian horses became a multi-million dollar industry.
Buyers are becoming involved strictly on the tax incentive end of it, not necessarily because of the horse.
Arabian horse breeder Charlene Bernstein.
Well, I think a lot of people went out and they had a dream. They always had a dream when they were young that someday they would own a horse and ride and blah, blah, blah. And a lot of money was being made and a lot of money needed to be sheltered. So people were willing to go out and invest a lot of money in horses that were being sold as pieces of art and history.
I work for people that never rode a horse.
Arabian horse trainer Jim Bloomfield.
I mean, they had millions of dollars worth of animals there that they never rode. And that's why the Arab industry was such a popular breed for people like that, because they just wanted something pretty. It had to look nice, just like their cars had to look nice and their home had to look nice. They wanted to bring something out that took people's breath away.
I think people are buying a dream. They're buying possessing something as ethereally beautiful as that.
Arabian horse trainer Donald Webb.
And because of the people promoting them in a certain way, that would appeal to a non-horse person, someone with bucks, someone who saw flair, liked it. And it's, you know, it was an interesting game to play, I think, from a business point of view. I always thought that the big stars that got into the Arabian horse thing were, you know, just simply had a friend who said, you know, you can do this, buy this, and you can write this off. Oh, I found it interesting to see Shirley MacLaine's face in the magazine. Not a horse picture, just one big page of Shirley MacLaine.
Wayne Newton had a lot of horses then. In California, we had a lot of people, very famous people. I think, like I said, they weren't so much that they rode them. They were convinced by their accounting people that horses are a good investment. You know, if they weren't riders before, they weren't riders. Or maybe a few might pick it up. But the primary drive was financial. And so they wanted the pretty horse.
Director Mike Nichols was interviewed in 1981 about his Arabian horses.
It's a little bit like the art market. The appreciation is as fast as some French Impressionist paintings and so forth. I think there are similar risks and some risks that you don't have when you're buying paintings. Obviously, paintings don't get sick and die, and you don't have to feed paintings. On the other hand, paintings don't have children. It really is more a question of what gets you excited and what is fun for you. Sensible people who buy paintings have told me that they buy them because they love them, and if they got lucky, fine. And I think to some extent it's true with Arabian horses. There are fewer risks breeding and buying Arabian horses than there are in some other breeds.
The Arabian horse industry was not specifically targeted by Reagan's new capital gains laws.
It was set up for legitimate farming. If you're a farmer, you have a tractor, tractor gets old, or your business is growing, you need a better tractor, a bigger tractor, or just the tractor can't keep up with the work anymore. If you sell the tractor, you get a capital gain, because the government feels you're not selling the tractor for profit, that you need the money to invest in the new tractor. So you get a capital gain. They tax you on 20%. 80% is tax-free. If you are a breeding farm, a broodmare is a baby-making machine. Therefore, it qualifies for a capital gain should you sell the horse.
Enterprising Arabian horse owners even held business seminars to introduce prospective buyers to the tax advantages.
The initial horse you may find after you've kept it 2 or 3 years and produced the foals, that you may sell that horse at an appreciated value and take capital gains treatment for your profit on selling the horse. So this is one of the characteristics, or a few of the characteristics, of tax shelters: the deductions of ordinary necessary expenses, and then at the end, when you sell some of your capital stock, or in the continuing process as you sell it, you can use capital gains treatment for it.
In order for this to work, these mares had to be in foal. You can't deduct, a brood mare who's not in foal has no value. You can't depreciate anything. There's no capital gain value. You sell a mare not in foal, it doesn't qualify for a capital gain. So in order for this to work, the mare has to be in foal. So that's why people bred anything and everything to keep their mares in foal. Stallions qualify for the same type of thing, but mares were far more desirable. Got to a point where breeding farms offered live filly guarantees. If you didn't get a filly, that you'd get another breeding. So it was beyond a live foal guarantee, it was a live filly guarantee. Because, like I said, for every stallion, a stallion can settle with artificial insemination 100 mares a season, but you have to have 100 mares for that. So, far more desire for mares. But there were some wonderful stallions, and there were some stallions that were used a lot that I wouldn't give you 10 cents for.
Because breeding was where the profit was, a tremendous amount of money went into advertising and promoting breeding stallions. Unfortunately for the breed, a number of these stallions didn't live up to their hype.
Oh, let's take national champion Strike. He couldn't breed his way out of a puddle. You occasionally see a horse that is okay. He does much better breeding national show horses than he does purebreds.
A Strike bred 90 mares as a 2-year-old. As a 3-year-old, he had most of them back, and his breeding life was very short. So they didn't do that because anybody thought that was the best thing for the horse. And they did it because they wanted the money. He was syndicated for $15 million or whatever it was.
And then you have things like Bay Shaw that come into the picture, who's like, you know, Mr. Super Sire. I saw him go champion at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. This horse bounces in, doesn't stand still for a second. You know, you can't really see his club feet or his upright pasterns. And he goes champion. And then he sires a whole bunch of things. You know, he's just breeding and breeding. And he reproduces these things. So, and the common thing is, well, you know, if you have a Bay Shaw, they have a bit of tendon surgery and then they're okay. And people are very accepting of this. When I found that out, I was really shocked. Because sure, that you might be able to change the angle of the pastern a bit, but that horse is going to founder at 7, and legs are going to fall off at 8. And Bay Shaw, of course, just, you know, permeates a whole lot of stuff. And I don't feel good about that. I think we'll be trying to those who breed thoughtfully will be trying to get rid of that for many generations to come.
And that is, I think, the big sorrow of it, is that when the money people got involved, they really didn't concern themselves with the breed. They concerned themselves with how can I make a dollar out of it. In fact, if you went to horse farms in those days, they all were like cattle. They had numbers wrapped around their necks, so the people breeding them would know who was who.
People were breeding horses that had no idea of what they were breeding, what they were buying, what they were going to end up producing. A lot of horses being produced that shouldn't have been on the ground.
So there were the old world type people, but no, most people, money, money, money. If you can make, if, you know, if I'm gonna make a money on it, I'll breed it to you. Nobody was that select as long as they made money, but there were some.
Arabian horse trainer Jill Snadicky, talking about her employers at Dunroman Arabians.
they really wanted to do right by the breed, I think, in their breeding program. I think it was more personal for them. You know, they really, really, really thought the horse was beautiful. You know, they always limited the breedings. They chose very carefully who they, you know, they, everybody who bred had to, they really had to know the mare. You couldn't just say, I'd like to breed, and you got to. They didn't really ever sell anything without meeting the person, without knowing what their goals were with the horse.
The goal for most of the big investors in the breed was to make a name for their horses at the most prestigious horse shows.
In Santa Barbara, a yearling halter class would have 40 horses in it. Take 2 hours. And then you go to Scottsdale, and there's 40 horses in a class that's really 100 and something horses that's been divided into three sections. I had horses that we used to bring to Scottsdale, and we'd be there 2 weeks. They'd come home, they'd actually, you know, zonk out for 2 weeks afterwards. Very tired, you know, because that's a lot. It's a lot of stress on a show horse. And in those days, it was even worse for the horse, because not only did you have the stress of competition, which you have today, but there was a lot more stress on everybody in there because there was so much money involved.
Oh, yeah. You could see the stress. You know, the big guys were sweating. It kind of sets up your year.
We've toned down a lot of our trainers' handling methods, and it's a little bit more humane. Is that the right way of saying it?
In the old days, you could hit your horse in the ring, and it was amazing to see a class of 20, someone would smack their horse, and at the sound of the whip, you know, 10 horses would drop to their knees, you know, just at the very sound.
Then we had more professionals riding the horses, and people were buying horses for the professionals to ride, and that was the thing to do was to be seen with your trainer who was riding your very fancy English horse.
In those days, there was a very short patience level. The sooner they're out there, the sooner they make, you know, they pay for themselves.
Some of the things that were done, I thought were silly to me, like the sanding the feet. You know, the black stuff around the eyes and everything. I just thought that was kind of silly to just, because you were changing the horse or, you know, trying to hide things, but, not trying to hide things, but, or accentuate things or.
People, as we know, had horses with trainers that maybe weren't really, the horse's best interest was not in their mind. And people would, as long as they would win and the value of the animal was increased by that, you know, they'd turn their head.
You get a title on a stallion, there you go. You've got your market set up for you. And a mare, you know, she does well, you can, you know, turn her over for big bucks.
No, money, money. Money drove everything in the 80s, early 80s. Money was the driving force for everything.
I go 120, now 5, now 30. I go 121, I go 130, now $40,000 dollar bill, they make it 40. I go 130, now 5. Now let's go ahead and start the bidding, boys. Now 50, now 50, now 60. I go 150, now 60. Now we're on the way. I go 150.
Arabian auctions over the last 5 or 6 years have gotten very jazzy, and I think I've partly, if not largely, contributed to that. they're very Las Vegas.
They were just fabulous to attend. Lots of fun. Entertainers, bands. Parties that went from morning until morning.
Yeah, the auctions were very grand because you had, first of all, it's that kind of money. The auction people got 22%. People who put on the auction got 22%. You had to send the horse 4 months ahead of time because they had to train it and condition it and have it looking. And the people that were buying them, anybody buying horses for $1 million, they have money. And what these farms do is they gather a bunch of people who have money, who are looking to invest. They sell them on the bloodlines of the horse, that they need this mare, that what she would do for your program. And they put all these people together in a room and tell them, you want that horse. And they will keep bidding. They're not going to let money stop them if they want something. But when you have Murdoch and Arm and Hammer and all of these people of that kind of thing in a room and they all want the same animal, you can believe that price is going to go sky high.
People coming, arriving in private jets and minks and jewels, and it was a Hollywood set. I was there as an observer and a spectator, and that was it. It was fun, and you know, I have to admit, we enjoyed it. The food, the entertainment, and of course, seeing these beautiful horses that were just groomed, and it was fabulous. Then there was another side of it that was kind of sad, seeing very pregnant mares that were about to foal and very stressful situations. That I didn't like. That I thought was wrong. Or youngsters. We had a lot of youngsters that would go through yearlings. And that was a very stressful situation for them, too, because when they were presented on stage, there would be a lot of lights, dark. First they'd enter the stage and there'd be no lights at all, and then the lights would shine on them, and sometimes we'd have green shavings or red shavings or sparkles or smoke and mist and all this stuff. So there was a lot of stress that was put on the horses dealing with all of this.
And these horses were making anywhere from a couple of $100,000 to $1 million for mares. One mare, the record mare, was $2.5 million.
What was Love Potion? I forgot now. 2.5, yeah. And how would she ever be able, in her lifetime, to make that kind of money back?
She was probably the horse that changed everything. Because $2.5 million is hard to warrant to the government. Because you'd have to average, you'd have to have 10 foals in a row that average a quarter of a million just to break even.
And there's other things behind that too. Well, she really couldn't produce. She was sterile, and there was a huge lawsuit over that.
1986 brought sweeping changes in tax legislation, and with these changes came an abrupt end to the Arabian horse boom. The economic effects of these new tax laws were most immediately felt in the wealthiest corners of the industry.
It's immediate. I mean, people who had horses that were bringing them $1 million, the minute those capital gains were lost, if you could get $50,000 for that same horse, you'd be lucky. Now that's a big difference. So, everything collapsed. Since the capital gains laws have changed, we have been registering a third of the numbers that we used to register. Supply and demand. We had all these horses, and nobody wanted them. There were farms that had to put horses down because they were so large, and they couldn't afford to feed them. And it's better to be put down than starve to death.
A lot of them ended up in Mexico, in France, and not as riding horses either. It was unfortunate. There were trailer loads that would leave from the bigger farms in Scottsdale, New Mexico. And if they didn't leave on the trailers, they were left starving in fields.
And in fact, if you had those horses, you lost your... A lot of people lost their shirt once that capital gains was done.
85 was the year that... Or 86. That Kenny Rogers bailed. And it was also the year that his barn burned. At Scottsdale. The big stars... I never took them seriously. Wayne Newton, one must take seriously. Mike Nichols, dedicated to his horses. I think those that stayed after the crash pretty much are proving themselves.
From 80 to 86, was thriving. From 86 to 90, was dead. It actually was a tale of two worlds. It was a thriving business driven by money for the first half. And the second half, it was... devastated, totally destroyed by the fact that we had just so many horses, with all of the people who were in it for the money had bailed out, and the only people left to take care of the mess were the people that were just horse people.
So I'm not quite sure what it'll take for the Arabian horse to turn around, or if it even should. Do we want the Arabian to be as big as the quarter horse? I really don't know.
I think the breed is better off without money drive as the driving force behind everything that's done in a horse's name, because rarely was the horse's best interest considered.
We have people that are breeding now that are actually love the Arabian horse, that they're not just producing numbers. It's not a number game anymore. I think more thought has been put into the breeding process.
There will always be people who love their horses, who love Arabians.
There aren't any that I don't like working with. I don't think I've ever come across one that I don't like working with.
They're smart. If they like somebody, they'll do anything for them. They'll die for them.
They satisfy everything that I want. Yeah, they're trustworthy and honest. What more could one ask for?